This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things Gumshoe. This is the second part of a three-part episode that we recorded on our Twitch channel, talking about Trail of Cthulhu and giving the overview of the game system, the core rulebook, and our take on that.
Let's talk about the investigation skills, because one thing, I think it was Mark who brought this up in the last episode, said, hey, they changed the investigative skills based on the game. And so let's start with Becca. Becca, what were kind of the standout cool investigative skills for you in Trail of Cthulhu? Page 24 in the physical book and possibly in the PDF as well.
I thought it was interesting to see the academic, interpersonal, and technical skills broken down like that. In Call of Cthulhu, it's alluded to these skills being in these separate categories, but you don't necessarily see them broken down this way. And I thought it really helped to kind of go, okay, well, as this character, am I an interrogator or an intimidator? No, I'm a reassurance, or I know my oral history, or I can bargain. I'm not going to lie, I did enjoy not only the fact that explosives is a general ability, but page 68 has very clear rules about all the different kind of explosives that you can use, from Molotov cocktail to like grenade. It's wonderful. So that one I enjoyed quite a bit.
Yeah, gas main is on that list. Mm-hmm. For when you really, like, you can't nuke it from orbit. It's the 1930s, but the gas main may be the only way to be sure.
Right.
Mark, what about you?
I liked evidence collection, which is a technical ability. And that's the physical collection, spotting the bloody footprint under the desk, that kind of a thing. Not to be confused with forensics, which is different. Mm-hmm. And the occult, which is your knowledge of the occult, which when you read about it, works really well with Cthulhu Mythos, which is a different academic skill, but they work well together, kind of, if you have both. But I like those. Kind of, you know something about the occult, you remember those, kind of, I liken it to like the Grimm's fairy tales aren't really fairy tales. They're the truth that we just spin into a fairy tale because it's been hundreds of years. And you're like, wait a minute, that's real.
Mm-hmm. I was happy to see that they brought over credit rating, which is always just a fascinating skill when you're running Call of Cthulhu. But I also love that they kept the Cthulhu Mythos ability, and it works very much like it does in Call of Cthulhu. It costs you sanity and stability when you use it, because you're using things that make you go, and when you do that, your brain doesn't react well. So they're very interesting mechanical reinterpretations, right? Because Call of Cthulhu has been around since 1981. It has a very strong following. It has some very, in no matter what they change in the system, there are some things that if they slaughtered those sacred cows, people would be done. Credit rating, mythos skill, sanity, and how they all interact are one of those things. And they were able to take those kind of touchstones that people expect from Cthulhu gaming and reinterpret them mechanically for Gumshoe. And I've really appreciated seeing kind of this honoring of the legacy, if you will. I know Becca ran a lot of Call of Cthulhu, so.
So how does Cthulhu Mythos tie into sanity? What's that mechanical rule?
Well, on page 74, thank you, Mark, when you use your Mythos, Cthulhu Mythos ability to kind of piece together the fragments that you find, it invites both a loss of stability, and if the discovery is terrifying enough, your sanity. And so basically, it kind of walks you through that you don't get a chance to deny it. You don't get a chance to call on all of these other mechanics that you have. If you willingly ask, what do I get from Cthulhu Mythos? Your sanity and your stability, just they drop, because there's no defense if you are willingly using the knowledge that you've possessed. And I love that. I also love that there is some defense, right? There's no defense in Call of Cthulhu. And I say that as a player in Trail of Cthulhu, not as the keeper in Call of Cthulhu. In Call of Cthulhu, I'm fine the way the rules work because I'm always the keeper. Now, the other things that they added in here, again, Pelgrane 10, I mean, look at 13th Age. Pelgrane loves narrative mechanics in their games. And that's something we all love too. So you have these sources of stability and these pillars of sanity. These are the things which you believe in or love, which the mythos encounters will attack and erode and destroy. Your pillars tend to be things you believe in. Country, honor, the church, your faith, science. They're abstract things that you believe. Your sources of stability are physical things. They're people you can go to and be recharged around. They're items that you love that you can clutch in those moments of terror. They're locations that you feel safe. As we talk about the rules, as you go through this, games, as your stability gets eroded, these things no longer, you don't have the connection to them anymore. You can't. The things you once believed in, you realize are just a lie. As the truth of the universe slowly grinds away at your sanity like a whetstone on the edge of a blade. Truly terrifying stuff. I don't know why I love cosmic horror as much as I do, but I'm getting very excited about playing in this game and seeing how quickly Becca will blast my sanity.
As fast as I can.
As fast as you can. Any other thoughts on character creation before we delve into game rules?
With your stability, just something like kind of the rules notes to add is that for like every 3 rating points you possess in stability, you have to name one person that keeps you sane. So, you know, if you have enough stability, great. You have, you know, 4 different people you can rely on. And that's, you know, 4 different people that the keeper can use to, you know, erode at your sanity. If, you know, maybe that happens. But I like that there's a tangible thing mm-hmm. to have written down, that these names plus your drive gives you that reason to do this thing.
Yeah. And I also love the fact, and this goes back to Call of Cthulhu, this is maybe what Mark was alluding to earlier, your sanity can never be higher than 10 minus your Cthulhu mythos rating. The more you get, you know, we need to come up with our own The More You Know GIF and have like Cthulhu tentacles trailing behind it.
More you know.
Yeah. Fatagan. All right, let's get into the game rules. So, Mark, do you want to walk us through one more time? I mean, I feel like you kind of walked through how investigative abilities worked real well already. Like, if you're in the area and you have the skill, you get the clue. But you kind of alluded to you could spend points. Let's do a quick review of that for those who are listening.
Yes, you have your spends and the benefits from that. So, and there's different clues that you put out there. They do explain that, and I don't know if we're going to cover that in the GM section. But when you create your campaign and your whole storyline, you should have some core clues that you really want the group to find. And those can float around, and you can present them to them in different ways. So there's certain clues that they should find. And then on your spends, and that's where we have less points, you notice there's very few points compared to general abilities. And that's because you don't need to have a 15 in art history. You put 1 or 2 points in it. I have art history. Hey, you see this picture, you remember something about it, you get the clue. Well, I have a point in it, so Becca being the keeper, hey, I want to spend a point to get more information. Mm-hmm. And it could be just some fluff, but I like to look at it as maybe some extra information to help. Remember, we talked about you're going to get this deluge of clues and how to sort them out. So if you do a spend, instead of just finding the matchbook you spend on it and you'll find more information about it. Maybe it's limited on where it was, or maybe with the spend, you know, yeah, here's a matchbook and it goes to Frankie's down in the corner, but I also know like where it was made, or yeah, this is from Frankie's, but this hasn't been in circulation for 2 years from the last owner. So this is an old matchbook type thing. So you throw something out there that's extra for the clue. Like I said, it won't give you a, I guess it gives you a better clue, not more clues. So it kind of helps define that clue more, so you can put it together on your little conspiracy board with the yellow string going from person to place and trying to figure out what's going on. Instead of just the one string, maybe you can have an extra one, a fuchsia one going over here going, okay, but there's also this aspect of it. So that's how you spend on your investigative abilities.
And for me, I was going to say, that's really where the improv for me as a GM would come from. What clues do the players want to dig into? Okay, well, let's riff a little bit there. All right, Mark, sorry about that.
Sure. No, that's kind of gives you some more stuff to help. Again, that's where we kind of were going back to our Patreon question. Here's the clue, but instead of saying, okay, here's the clue, attack the warehouse, that's where they're at, you put out clues that will eventually lead them there, or maybe it's not at the warehouse, it's at, you know, Count Dracula's castle over here in Transylvania they have to travel to. And you give them those spends to give them a little more information on why is this an important clue. I guess that's one thing, is why is this an important clue? And under general abilities, it's a little bit different. You've got more points, and you'll have more points probably in those pools. They do suggest putting some in some of the things, like if I'm a military guy, I should probably be able to shoot and fight better than other things, like hypnosis. That's in a skill in there. I probably don't need it. But an alienist, that's probably one of their skills, to put you under hypnosis to get information when you've blocked it, because I can't think about what I saw, and you can bring it forward. So they'd have those skills in hypnosis. The thing with the general abilities is there's going to be some sort of a contest. Either the keeper sets a number that you have to reach, or if it's, say, because this isn't really, I mean, you get into combat, but this isn't really a combat system. But say you're being chased by the cultist, and I don't really want to fight it, so I want to flee. Well, now it's a contest between me and the cultist, and I put the points in that I want to spend, because it's all the D6. So like, you know what, I'm going to spend a point, or I'll spend 2 points to assure I get a success. The cultist goes, and we go back and forth until either one of us fails or we give up. Say you're fighting someone, and they just give up, surrender, or you can flee, and you succeed in fleeing away. So there's different kinds. Some of them are set. Like athletics, I try to jump from one roof to the next. The keeper would give me a number. I have to reach it. And it comes out of your pool that you have in there.
Yeah. And it's generally between 2 and 6. And you're rolling a single D6. So if something's a 2 or a 3, you could leave it to chance. Something's a 6, 7, or 8. Like 7 or 8, you have to spend points from your pool. And you don't get those pools back till you get a refresh. Should also note that you have minimums, and like you get certain, like you get four free points of sanity, and you get 3 points in, I believe, sanity, stability, and health for everybody, just because everyone has those skills, if you will, to start.
You get 4 sanity, 1 health, and 1 stability.
Oh my gosh. My alienist will stay at 1 health and 1 sanity, and we will see what comes of it. No.
Yeah. But it tells you right in there. Yeah. And that's when I was looking at it. I'm like, okay, I got the points. Oh, wait, you get these free points put in there. And then if it's one of the abilities of your occupation, it's, you know, 1 point gets you 2 points in your pool. So you can get more in it at less points, which is kind of cool. So that's how the general abilities is. You're going to roll a contest and you might fail. And the keeper will let you know. You don't have to. The only one is sense trouble is the only one they suggest you don't give them your target number. The other ones you can. And I, as a keeper, I probably would. Hey, you're going to need to roll this to succeed. You know, jump from the roof, or you need a 5.
Right.
Something like that.
But sense trouble, I like that the default is this is the, like, because you never know if there is trouble.
No.
You know, it always looks clear. We're not going to get deep into the weeds here, but they have all of the things you would need for a 1930s pulp-ish Trail of Cthulhu. You have rules for combat. You have rules for contests between characters and NPCs. You have great rules for chases. As Mark and Becca pointed out, fleeing is a skill in Trail of Cthulhu. The ability to run for your life is a core skill that you should definitely invest in. And again, as we said, they split up sanity and stability. Sanity really represents how many mental or emotional hits you can take in the short term. Sanity is the big hits that may have lasting consequences for you from willingly using Mythos abilities or when Mythos shocks drop you to zero stability. Now, they've done a really great job of there's a symbol that you can follow along with that if you want to play purist, if you're like, the basic rules are too easy for my players and I want a more terrifying Lovecraftian experience, they've just coded all of those occupations and all of those rules that you're going to want to use with the purist symbol. Everything else is free game if you're playing basic or pulp. So let's get into the next section, which is the Mythos section. It's the GM section, and it covers essentially four big topics. The Mythos, the 1930s, GMing advice, and frameworks. One of the problems that we have as game masters is the fact that no matter what game we're running, this happens even in Jackals now, players become familiar with the strangeness of the world. No matter how many times I try to not describe a Takan, people figure it out. I'm running a second edition D&D game for kids, and I never use the name of the monsters. So every time they encounter something, it's what do they see? What do they smell? What do they hear? And they don't know. They haven't memorized the monster manual. So they're just like, oh my gosh, it's something with a pig face and tusks. We should run. Mm-hmm. That's even true of Cthulhu Mythos. People read Lovecraft. They've played through video games. They've seen it in movies. They've read the stories. Deep ones just aren't scary for them anymore. And what Robin Laws and the guys involved with Trail of Cthulhu have done is they give you, and this continues into the bestiary that we're going to talk about next month, they give you 5 or 6 different options for every Mythos god, for every monster. So your players, they're like, ha-ha, Ashaga, I read about that. Really? Because you don't know what kind of Shoggoth this is. My favorite is, say they encounter Haster. Haster is from the Chambers play, The King in Yellow, gets folded into the Cthulhu Mythos quite a bit. There are 10 different possibilities of what Haster may be. My favorite is, Haster is a interstellar space meme that takes residence in people's brains when they see the yellow sign. What does that mean? I don't know, but neither will your players. What did you guys think about the bestiary? It was like maybe a monster that stood out to you or an elder god that stood out to you that you really liked about this section.
No, they all scare the bejeebies out of me.
Excellent.
Yeah, they're all, you know, and it's a little bit different, I think, because a lot of them, like, you know, Hastor and Dagon, you're not going to face them. Or if you see them, you're going to either lose your sanity or just run away. Because mm-hmm. I don't care how many, I think they even quote it in the book, it doesn't matter how many Thompsons you bring to that fight, you're not taking it down. So you might as well just run away, hide under your bed, and pretend it didn't exist, and hope you didn't lose all your sanity. Right. But there are a few, I think some of the, like, Migos.
Yeah, the Migos.
That, you know, you might meet, but it's still not a good thing. I threw them against a pulp. I used them as a basis for a creature that my pulp group fought, but it wasn't a Cthulhu thing. It was just some weird critters for them. But they're like, what? You know, come out of the sea in trench coats, and they didn't know what it was.
Excellent.
I'm not going to lie. Since my Call of Cthulhu game, I have been a bit of a fan of Ithaqua.
Yeah.
Windwalker.
The Windwalker, yes.
Mm-hmm. Because it's just enough to match a Wendigo
mm-hmm.
to make my characters or my players are nervous. But there's you know, for a cannibal man eating giant monster who roams the woods and snowy wastes, that's not enough. The Wendigo isn't quite terrifying yet, but you know, something that can take over your body, can steal your mind with the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watched my Call of Cthulhu game, you watched me take dear sweet, hang on, Paul had an M name for all of his characters. It wasn't Miles. His boxer. Dagnabbit. All of your M names. I don't know. I took his brain, left him a, you know, feeble husk of a man. But then just to be able to read and see that there's several different options for the Ithaqua, which is kind of fun.
And also in the mythos section, you've got spells, you've got monsters. Some of the monsters are terrifying. Like the Dark Young of Shub-Niggurath is 26 points in their fighting pool.
Which I think is appropriate because as I think about it, I'm like, Cthulhu rising up from the deep. Like, it's a terrible thing, but if it happens, like, we're all dead, like, moving on. But if there's a monster that can, like, find its way through my window at night to attack me in bed, like, that's a little bit more personal. That makes it a little bit more terrifying.
It really is. I like sort of the idea of the Elder Gods there is, what is the basis for their cults and their creatures? And then you get the cool monsters and kind of how you theme them. They also give us several cults just right out of the gate to use for all of your evil pleasure. The next section is the...
We'll be back in 2 weeks to finish up this discussion of the Trail of Cthulhu core book and what our thoughts on it was.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast.
You've been listening to the Iconic Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com. Also, check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and more information about the show. Thanks for listening.